Hello, and welcome to this episode of Girl Boss Interrupted. I'm your host, Helen Roy. So if you follow me on Twitter, you may know that one of the topics that I've set my heart on covering in this new season of the pod is a difficult one, infertility. This week's episode on miscarriage may be difficult to hear for people who have suffered the loss of a child, but I sincerely hope that you stick around. As a respected commentator, editor, and author, my guest, Faith Moore, has written beautifully about her own fertility struggles. And in this episode, we talk about the reality of life in the womb, the unspeakable grief of loss, and ways that women can honor their babies postmortem, as well as hold on to hope. Check out the description of this episode for her links, and if you find it edifying, make sure to leave a like, comment, and share with your friends. See you again in 2 weeks. Okay, so Faith, welcome to Girl Boss Interrupted. I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited too.
Well, I'd like to start off this episode by asking you about your personal journey. If I understand it correctly, your miscarriage story is actually pretty closely intertwined with a conversion story. So let's start there. How did you sort of reach the conclusions you're at now about the reality of life in the womb and the reality of the Creator?
Yeah, great question. Okay. I have now two children, but I had a miscarriage before I had my first child. So this was around 8 or 9 years ago, and it was a miscarriage that happened at about 8.5 or 9 weeks gestation. And was fairly prolonged in the sense that I kind of was in a sort of limbo state of thinking that something was probably wrong, but not really knowing, and going to the doctor and having them keep doing ultrasounds and keep finding a heartbeat and keep saying, oh no, it's fine. Everything is fine. But I knew, because of what was going on in my body that something was wrong. So in terms of the sort of faith journey, I was not a religious person at all. I would say I was probably maybe an agnostic in the sense that I believed in some kind of world beyond this world and maybe some kind of higher power, but I wasn't sure. But I found that in this time I was praying. I was praying all the time, both kind of like on purpose, like in the morning, like kind of, I didn't really know how to pray or what to do, but sort of like putting my hands together and saying, please God, let this baby be okay. And also just kind of throughout the day, as I kind of noticed things that were happening in my body that were concerning, just again, please God, let this baby be okay. I just kept saying that, even though I didn't know really who God was or who I was talking to in general. And ultimately the baby was not okay. Ultimately I went in again for one of those times and there was no heartbeat. And, we can talk more if you want about kind of what that was like and how that experience went. But just to answer your question about how it was tied to faith, it was a long process, which again, I can talk about if you want. But basically at the end of it, I was able to receive some information, some scientific information about what had happened that had caused the miscarriage, and was able to learn that it was kind of a fluke. It was a sort of abnormality that was not something genetic for me or my husband. It was not likely to happen again, but it was something that had the baby continued to grow, would have been catastrophic for the baby, for us. It was not, the baby couldn't live with that abnormality. And so I suddenly realized that I had been praying the wrong thing. I had been praying without knowing the full picture, and that there was somebody who did have the full picture. That the person that I was praying to knew something, some picture of the world of life that I didn't know, and answered the prayer that I didn't know to ask for. And that prayer was that, that this child couldn't be, this child couldn't be. And he knew that, in even when I didn't know that. And so I felt very much that he was there and that he was looking out for me in that moment. And it took a long time from that moment for me to be able to say, yes, I'm a Christian, and to get baptized, which I did eventually do, and to really accept that. But I did go, I think it was maybe a couple of months later, or maybe a month later, to a church, and I lit a candle for the baby, and I knelt there and I just cried and I said goodbye. And that too, there's nobody to bury. There's nobody, you don't have a funeral. You don't get to do any of those things. I didn't know that I could ask for the baby back. I didn't know that. And so I didn't have anything to do. So I did that. I lit a candle in a church that I didn't belong to and that I wasn't even a member of, and said goodbye. And so that piece, I mean, you kind of asked two things about the faith and also the sort of knowledge of the life in the womb and that it is a life. So, I mean, I know that a lot of the discourse around, you know, whether a baby in the womb is a human being centers around people's religious convictions about it. But actually, my conviction that it was a life and my religious conversion didn't really go hand in hand.
Yeah.
So I really kind of came to that belief because when you're pregnant, that's a baby. And it was my baby, and my baby died. And it doesn't matter to me that it was only there for 8.5, 9 weeks. That's not important. That was my baby, and my baby was gone. And so, I think we'll probably get into this more, but like, you know, the doctors and the people that were there with me in the room when they told me that there was no heartbeat were the same doctors who had been in the room saying, look, he's waving at you. Look at your little peanut. Look at your baby. Oh, like, I wonder if it's a boy or a girl. Like, they also knew.
Hmm.
Even though these are people who would have counseled someone, been fine with somebody going to get an abortion, for example, these people also knew that was my baby. And so I think I can't speak for other people. I don't know how other people go through the experience of pregnancy without knowing for certain that what they're carrying is a child, even from the very beginning. But that was my experience. And that's also why I needed to say goodbye. Yeah. You know, I mean, I needed that closure. If there can be any closure, I needed that because I was saying goodbye to someone that I had already gotten to know in some way.
Yeah. I think that in a culture that is so fixated on denying this reality, I'm glad that you brought this up. In a culture that is so fixated on denying that reality, women who are suffering miscarriage or infertility for any reason are gaslit by many, many different people in society, from the doctors to other women. And I think a lot of women who are suffering miscarriage find themselves in an almost awkward space of unknowing or of not understanding how to move on, just being stuck, you know, being emotionally stuck and feeling just strange and reticent about sharing their experience or honoring the life that was inside of them. So my question is, do you agree with that? Did you feel, perhaps not even in the moment, but upon reflecting, do you sense that there's this, you know, extremely ambivalent attitude toward women who are miscarrying in this society?
Yeah, absolutely. There is a taboo around miscarriage in our country. And I believe that it stems almost directly from the discourse around abortion. So for me, people don't talk about miscarriage. They don't talk about it. And, you know, when you have one, then you suddenly understand, I don't know what the statistics are, but it's like many, many women have had a miscarriage or will have a miscarriage. And, you know, and I had one, and there are many women who have many, many miscarriages. And so I'm very aware of that, you know, my story is one story, but there are women who suffer 5, 10, you know, miscarriages as they try to figure out whether they can conceive a healthy child or not. And I really think that the fact that we don't talk about it is because that the narrative around pregnancy is that what is being lost during a miscarriage is not a baby. Mm. And so, except that most women, I think, who have had a miscarriage feel at least somewhere inside of them that what they have lost is a baby. And so how can you talk about what has happened to you if you're not allowed to use the language of what you believe to be true, which is that you are suffering a loss in the same way that losing a person is a loss? And if you can't talk about that, and if what you're being told is, oh, this is just some tissue, this is just some, you know, I mean, I heard all kinds of things from doctors after I had a miscarriage. This is some tissue, this is the products of conception, there was a lot of it, like we can remove it, or it can be removed, like it can be removed, you know, and nobody says, you know, there's acknowledgement of the disappointment that you might feel, that you thought you were going to be a mother and you're not now. But there's no acknowledgement of the loss that you have suffered. Nobody says, I'm so sorry for your loss. They say, oh, I'm sorry, this pregnancy is not that viable or something like that. Yeah. And so I think that women who buy into the narrative that abortion is a good thing, that the baby in the womb is not a baby, you know, who want to be sort of good, upstanding citizens in that narrative, can't express what they truly feel when this is happening to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's a real disservice to women who, because then what happens is you are silenced. You're silent. I mean, you're almost silencing yourself because you think that you're existing within, you know, within this narrative that suddenly is dissonant with what you are experiencing just personally as a human. And so I think that, yeah, there's really a way in which we're not doing women any service by not acknowledging how devastating it can be, not just because, oh, you're disappointed, but oh, because, you know, you've lost this baby. And for some women, it's like you've lost so many, you know, you've lost all these babies, you know, and that's worth acknowledging.
Right. I mean, if only for so many reasons, life needs to be honored and the end of lives need to be honored. I mean, there are reasons that every culture has funeral rites, often elaborate rituals surrounding the sort of transition to the next life. And it's important. It's deeply important. And it's important because of what you believe happens to people who die, but it's also important for the living to, mm-hmm. I mean, you use the word closure, and I think that's a good one. It's just the process of grief needs to happen, I think, for people to psychologically just be well. I mean, like, I think a lot of women are probably moving around with a lot of emotional baggage about lives that have been lost in their wombs. And this is true for women who miscarry. This is also true for women who abort their children, having convinced themselves of a lie. I see that. I sense that in society. There's like a general sadness in women. There's a general sort of psychological unwellness. And so my next question is sort of coming back to this political question and this sort of what's been happening with Roe v. Wade has caused a lot of a lot more lies, a lot more elaborate lies to sort of come to the surface. And one of them, which I think is just the most detestable thing I've ever heard in my life, is abortion saves lives because women who miscarry need abortions in order to survive their miscarriage. Obviously, for anyone who's been through it, for anyone who knows anything or who understands that words have meaning, a DNC, which is the procedure that doctors use to remove the embryo and the placenta when a pregnancy fails, is not an abortion because the child is already dead.
Yes.
Have you noticed this rhetoric popping up, and what do you think about it?
Yes, I'm so glad that you brought this up. Even the doctor who performed my DNC, who was an amazing man and really, I mean, saved, if not my life, my emotional state at the time, even he said to me, you know, thank goodness abortion is legal because otherwise I wouldn't be able to do this procedure. This is a completely nonsensical thing to say, right? The procedure that is done on women who have miscarried is the same procedure, like a DNC is performed on someone who needs an abortion or wants an abortion and somebody who has miscarried, with the enormous difference that if the baby is still alive, the DNC kills the baby. But if the baby has already died through miscarriage, then that was the cause of the baby's death, not the DNC procedure. And so I absolutely have seen this, that like, oh, if we outlaw abortion, then people can't deal with their miscarriages. Well, that's not true at all. That this medical procedure can still be done on people who have had a miscarriage and not tamper with the fact that we're not allowed to do abortions because it's not an abortion. An abortion, I mean, just think of the word, like the word abortion, it means to stop, yeah. Right? Like if you're going to abort something, it means like if you're going to abort a mission, it means stop mm-hmm. the mission, right? Mm-hmm. So in a woman who has miscarried, it's already been stopped. It's mm-hmm. already happened. And, you know, and I think medically, a miscarriage is sort of sometimes called like an abortion in the sense that the pregnancy mm-hmm. has
a spontaneous abortion. Yeah.
Yes, a spontaneous abortion. Exactly. So I think that's just another sort of, again, like you said, gaslighting type of rhetoric to make people think like, oh, you know, if we need abortion, because if we don't have it, then what will people do in these life-threatening situations where they've had a miscarriage, but they can't, you know, expel the embryo and the placenta on their own? It's kind of, you know, I don't see how that follows in any way. And I think it's not fair. I mean, because the thing is, like, you know, before I had a miscarriage, I'd never heard of a DNC, or, you know, some of the different like oral drugs you can take, you know, after your miscarriage that are also abortion drugs. So I think, you know, for some people, they're just like, oh, well, okay, you know, that, and so that's not fair either, that, you know, people are, I think, on purpose putting out false information in order to bolster their case. And, you know, this is kind of technical medical information that people wouldn't necessarily already know. So I absolutely agree. I think that I hate that. I think that's awful.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, the difference between an abortion and a post-miscarriage DNC is the difference between burning someone alive and cremating them. It's like, I think we can right. all I think we can all tell a difference here. Yeah, it's the same procedure, but you'd have to be pretty blind or dishonest to not be able to tell the difference.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'll just say that when I had my miscarriage and when I needed a DNC, I was told the only places that the people I was seeing at the time could recommend for me were abortion clinics, where I would be sitting in the waiting room with women who were purposefully trying to end the lives of their babies, sitting there with my baby who was not alive anymore, you know, and that, like, I know that's different, right? Even at the time when I was sort of still questioning all of these things, like, I could tell that my situation and their situation were not the same thing. I mean, even if I was somebody who was still pro-abortion, which I'm not, you know, which I'm not, like, I think I could probably still tell that the situation of somebody who was there for a miscarriage and the situation of somebody who was there for an abortion are different. Those are different experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just wild. It's the fog of war in an information war, right? Just like stirring up all of this dirt. And it's in order to make things so unclear with a topic that's already so uncomfortable for so many people that they don't want to question it and they don't want to. And, you know, I think they're really using people's pain against them too, because women who have had a miscarriage who maybe haven't, I hate the term do the work, but sort of done the emotional processing, you know, of dealing with that. I think that if you like hit them in that trigger point, then you can just sort of make them dance. Which is why I think that it's actually important for people who are pro-life unapologetically to talk about miscarriage and talk about the tragedy of miscarriage and really honestly what that feels like. And the fact that it feels like the worst thing in the world. I do want to ask you about that. What does it feel like? And I don't mean physically, but emotionally. What were some of the thoughts that you had when you knew that you were losing your baby?
Yeah. So beforehand, you know, when I thought that I was, but I wasn't sure, you know, it was a sort of desperate, I felt like, you know, a sort of desperate, like holding on. I think I knew before I was told, you know, and then my main feeling, I think, and I think this is important because it's another reason that we don't talk about it. My main feeling was guilt. I felt that I had been entrusted with this life to grow inside of my body. And somehow, for some reason, my body wasn't able to do that. I wasn't able to sustain this life in my body. And I remember sobbing on the couch to my mother. I mean, sobbing so hard she couldn't understand what I was saying. But what I was saying was, I'm so sorry. I'm so, so sorry that I couldn't keep you, that I couldn't let you stay. And I think that's how we know we're moms, is that we feel guilt. You know, I think there's no way to be a mom without feeling guilty about something. And so this was my first experience of that, because obviously, and I do want to say this in case anyone listening is going through this experience, I do want to say that it wasn't my fault. There was nothing I could do. It's not anybody's fault that they had a miscarriage. And, you know, but I felt I was this child's mother and I had failed at my first task, which was to keep it alive until it could be born. And I think, you know, we don't talk about that either, you know, that this, because that would acknowledge that I had become a mother, that I was a mother at that time, even though I didn't have any living children. You know, in that moment of conception, that baby was my child and I was its mother, and I had a sacred duty. I felt I had a sacred duty to care for that child. And I had, you know, I had let that down. I had let my child down. And, you know, I think that's the piece that, I mean, even still, I feel, you know, that even, I mean, I think it helped me to know what had gone wrong. It helped me to sort of see that there was a kind of like a biological thing had happened that made it so that, you know, the pregnancy couldn't continue, because it meant that I hadn't done anything. It wasn't something that, you know, that it was something I ate or something I did, you know, it just happened. But I think, so that's one thing it feels like, you know, it feels like incredible guilt. For me, there was a period of time in which the baby was not alive, but still inside of my body. And that felt incredibly difficult for me, that there's really no closer bond that you can have with someone than that they are growing and living inside of your body. And, you know, but now the baby was not living, but was still there. And there was something kind of frightening and horrible to me about that. But then when it was over and I had had the DNC, then there was the incredible loss, you know, then my baby was just gone and I don't know where it went. I still don't know. There was no closure. You know, and it feels, and I think also in some ways, I mean, this is kind of a trivial word, but it feels humiliating to have a miscarriage. I mean, I hadn't really shared my pregnancy with many people, but I think, you know, if you have, then you have to go back around to all those people and say, you know, actually it's not happening. And, you know, even just, you know, in that sense of anything, any kind of good news that you had, if you, you know, getting a new job or, you know, getting married or whatever, like, you know, if you, you know, you think that in yourself and any of the people that you've shared it with, they're going along thinking that, and then you kind of have to drop that, you know, drop that on them as well as it's been dropped on you. And so, you know, you're not, you know, and, you know, and I think this is kind of part of the bigger picture that we don't acknowledge, but, you know, at least for me, I was very clear that that being a mother was the great work of my life, that's what I wanted to do. And I thought that I was embarking on that, and then I wasn't. And so I felt adrift, you know, what do I do now? Yeah. So I think those are some things I felt.
Yeah. How long did it take you, to sort of feel like yourself again?
That's a good question. Many months. I mean, I think I remember sort of wanting to try again very quickly, you know, like wanting to kind of get back on track, or, you know, get back to whatever, but also being very aware that the next baby was a different baby. Yeah. You know, that there was that. And I think this again is also something that we don't let women acknowledge, you know, it's like, oh, you know, I'm pregnant. I'm going to have a baby. Oh, I'm not pregnant. I'm not going to have a baby. Oh, look, I'm pregnant again. Great. I'm right back where I started from. Fantastic. I'm back on track. Right. But no, I mean, like in some ways, no, because, you know, you're back on track in the sense that now, hopefully you're going to now have a viable, healthy pregnancy, but like you've still, you've still lost that other baby, and you know, you're still always going to have lost that other baby. Yeah. And, you know, so I think, you know, I don't know how it took me a long time. I mean, I think even, I don't know, because it's still, I mean, it's still with me. Right. So, I mean, obviously I'm not still
never the same.
Sobbing on the couch, but yeah, right, I don't know. Right. I don't, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Grief just has this way, I think, of making a home in your skin forever. But are there any ways, I mean, you mentioned that you had gone to the church and lit a candle in order to say goodbye, but are there any ways presently that you maintain a connection, or, you know, talk to your baby, or think of them, or call them to mind, or, you know, do you have any sort of relationship with them now?
That's a good question. You know, when it happened, you know, my mother gave me a necklace. That this is a thing. Some people, there's sort of miscarriage jewelry that people sometimes use to help them to grieve. And, you know, it was just a little tiny, tiny heart on a chain. And for a long time, I didn't feel like I wanted that. I sort of, you know, and she gave it to me, not necessarily for that. She just, you know, it was a little heart on a chain, you know, and I said to her, is this for the baby? She said, it's, you know, it's for anything that you want it to be. And when I finally converted and, you know, was baptized as a gift for my baptism, my parents gave me a cross on a chain. And I took the heart from the first chain and I put it on the chain with the cross. And that, to me, is a symbol of what happened to me. Mm. And so for me, you know, the loss of that child is very, very, very interwoven with my journey toward, you know, toward Christianity and belief. And so I think, you know, there is that piece for me always. And, you know, and I don't know, at the time, you know, I was not, you know, again, I was not religious at the time, but, you know, we talked about, you know, who other loved ones who had died, who were in heaven or in some afterlife, and that the baby was with them, you know, that the baby was being cared for by, like, you know, my grandmother, or, you know, somebody that we knew that would love the baby. And I think, you know, I still sometimes think about that, you know, and I don't know what the truth is, you know, about what happens up there. You know, that's beyond my pay grade.
Right. Theologically, it's a little bit hard to figure out, but that's okay.
Exactly. I don't actually think that I need to know that, but I think that, you know, I certainly believe that wherever the baby went is a good place where they're cared for. And so I find solace in that too.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Gosh, I really do appreciate that. Living now in a pretty traditional Catholic community, I'm surrounded by women who are high fertility, but that also comes with, you know, a high rate of loss as well.
Right.
And something that I think is very special is that for the women who are able to retrieve the remains of their miscarried children, they do have. It's not quite a funeral rite, but the church has a specific sort of ritual to do that, and they name their children and they talk to their children and they sort of include them in the family life and in the sort of family lore, the family legacy, and you know, their living children will know their their angel babies' names. And I think that that can be a really important way for people to acknowledge, appreciate, and honor life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and also, you know, as speaking back to the sort of tabooness of it all, to kind of open that door for people and for, you know, our kids. Yeah, I mean, my children know that before they were born, there was another baby that didn't make it. And, you know, that's something that is a part of our family and our story. And I think, yeah, I think that's important. And I just, you know, I appreciate this forum, by the way, also to be able to speak about it, because I think, you know, I want to speak about it as much as I possibly can, because I want other people to understand that it is something that, first of all, can be spoken about if you feel comfortable, but also, you know, that it is a something, that it is a thing. You know, it's not just, you know, oh, you know, I thought I was going to buy my car today, but they didn't have the color that I wanted, so I'll buy my car tomorrow. Like, it's not that, you know, it's a real thing, a real loss. And I think most people feel it in that way, even if they don't allow themselves to express it. And so I think, you know, the more that we can talk about the ways that it really does affect us, the more people might hear that and know, oh, what I'm experiencing is valid and, you know, acceptable. It's okay to feel this way.
Right. Yeah. That reminds me, one of my favorite, she's a Catholic saint and, just my favorite intellectuals of all time. She was a pupil of Husserl, actually, Edith Stein. And I'm not sure if you've ever heard of her, but she's wonderful. She was ethnically Jewish, who converted to Catholicism, but was martyred in Auschwitz. And, she wrote several essays on women. And one of them, you know, writing about the feminine genius, says that women are concerned with, like, the female soul is concerned with things in the whole. They're concerned with the personal. The realm of abstraction is essentially foreign to us. And I think that, like, you know, the way that you've just laid that out, it reminded me of that, because it's like that's the realm that women, I think, have been sort of forced to view their bodies and their children in, is this world of abstraction, right? Which is sort of unreal. And right. It's helpful. It's really helpful to be able to speak about these things as they are whole human beings, the reality of life. I mean, this isn't an abstraction. It isn't just some sort of like disembodied idea. No, it's a thoroughly embodied reality. So I like to kind of close these podcasts out with asking my guests, what kind of advice they have for people, but specifically women, who are sort of trying to navigate the modern world and find better ways of being women. So do you have any advice for my dear listeners?
Sure. I think one thing that would help us all is to appreciate and understand that your femininity is valid, worthwhile, and a part of who you are. Our current culture wants us to be just like men. That, you know, the current culture is that in order for women to be strong and powerful, they need to be just like men, which is actually horribly demeaning. And, you know, basically sets up a system in which men are always going to be better than women. And I think, just to sort of tie it into what we've been talking about today, women are biologically and spiritually, I think, tuned in to the creation of other people, of procreation and nurturing life. And I think if that is your calling, if that is what you want, then don't wait. I think is my advice. Don't wait, because you can't wait. And a lot of infertility happens because we wait, and then we're so old that we struggle. And so I think don't feel that in order to be a successful woman in the world, you have to have had a high-powered career just like a man. There's no reason that you should do that unless that is your calling in life. So I think if we could just recalibrate our minds so that we saw motherhood as the highest of all possible life paths, because it is, then I think we would be a lot happier. And so I feel very grateful that after my miscarriage, I was able to then have two children, and that being their mother is the great work of my life. And there is no other. Everything else that I do is tangential or unimportant. This is the great work of my life. And I wish that other people could feel the same when they want to. So I guess that's it.
Gosh, that is so beautifully said. I could not have said that better. Wow. Faith Moore, thank you so much for joining me. This has been a really special episode. So
thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I hope to have you back.
Great. And I would love to come back.
Yeah, absolutely. So listeners, we will chat again soon. I will put all of Faith's, as always, I will put all of her work and her socials in the description box, so you can check her out too. And we will chat again soon. Bye now.
Thanks so much.